listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be home. I got in on Friday night, and after a pretty intense month in Washington, so it's good to be in nerdland talking about the things that really matter to us. And the topic I've been assigned today is to discuss antitrust in the internet area. And I think it's a timely discussion. I'm not going to discuss individual cases or companies. I don't think that would be fair or appropriate. But certainly, we are aware of the role of the federal government.
I'm not getting in.
District attorneys for antitrust enforcement in the global economies. Certainly, the two divisions of the federal government, the Department of Justice and the FTC, were relatively quiescent. I know we have some of the Microsoft and you may disagree, but were relatively quiescent over the last 8 years. There were, as the internet economy has developed and matured and grown, it's been interesting to see, and my observation has been that it's not just the enforcement actions that have a dramatic impact on the internet economies, but it's the discussion of the possibility of an enforcement action that can have a tremendous impact on what happens in the internet space. Think about the proposed merger of Oracle and PeopleSoft and the impact that the potential of antitrust enforcement had in that. And now, after 8 years of relative quiescence, we have Christine Vardy, the new head of the antitrust division, who has been very, very vocal in her intent to ramp up enforcement in the Obama administration, and she's particularly noted the internet space. In her first policy speech, I'm going to make a quote in case people have not become aware of this. She said, and this is just in May, "It is my hope that the antitrust division, drawing upon the significant expertise of my new leadership team, will have the opportunity to explore vertical theories and other new areas of civil enforcement, such as those arising in high-tech and internet-based markets. Increasingly, Americans are relying on high-tech solutions in the home and workplace and enjoying the fruits of innovation in those markets and that have been spurred by competition and rival forces." And specifically, she withdrew the policy guidance from the Bush administration on the enforcement of Section 2 of the Sherman Act against single firm conduct. And that's really what that means in plain English, is that antitrust laws often target agreements between companies, mergers, and the anti-competitive potential of those mergers. And Section 1 of the Act prohibits price fixing other anti-competitive agreements between companies. But the single firm conduct allows the actions of a single company on a merger and the activities that they are engaged in as a potential violation of the Act. Withdrawing that prior announcement, the Bush administration, I think, did very much catch the attention of the Valley in general, and certainly it did catch the attention of the Judiciary Committee. Just in blunt, I think the concern is if the Bush administration did too little, there is concern whether Ms. Varney and the Obama administration could do too much, because the targets could be everywhere, and the danger is showing innovation. Here are some examples of big fat targets. Cloud computing. In the cloud, I, as a consumer, see more control over my data. What if I want to switch? Is my data affordable? If it isn't, then there's going to be a big cost to switching, which might stop me from using a better service. Is this a restraint of trade? Software and web-based platforms. Can a dominant company use control over a platform to push aside either direct competitors or competitors in vertical markets, meaning other products that use the platform? In the ancient tech world, and I think the classic case in the ancient tech world was the US versus Microsoft, we saw really Microsoft destroying Netscape. I remember coming back and meeting repeatedly at the request of Netscape, the parade of horrors and sapping to them, and the and in the end, the Justice Department expressed some interest. But of course, by the time that happened, Netscape was gone, all their employees had left. And I think the conclusion that that really leads me to and others is that really the traditional enforcement actions are not really where it's at. It's the decision to inquire early on. And of course, the government waited for quite a long time in the Microsoft case. That is the operative factor. Net neutrality has often been discussed, and we have great hopes that the Obama administration, through the FCC, is going to deal effectively with this issue. But the real issue is, can the network providers distort competition for applications and content by giving particular content and applications preferential access? Interoperability and standardization are also competition issues. And, you know, it's interesting that net neutrality, which really has the potential to completely control who has access to what content, is the one thing that seems not to be of interest to the DOJ regulators. But we do have hopes with the new FCC forming up as an issue that will be a subject of interest. The openness and interoperability of the net creates enormous value. And whether it's a search engine, a mobile phone, social networking platform, the open-endedness creates tremendous possibilities for different users. And these open possibilities in applications can all be provided by a single company. So there's a big incentive to open a platform up to others. This creates a tension between open access on the one hand and the profits and control of the platform provider on the other, and we can all think of examples of that even in this very valley. It raises issues. Will the platform owner also compete in the markets for content and applications that use the platform? And if it's non-exclusive, does that create a constraint for it? If it is exclusive, is that a subject of interest? The network effects are also crucial. As more people use a particular platform, it becomes more valuable, and this can naturally lead to dominant companies who might then be able to use such network effects and other economies of scale to preserve their dominance against competitors. Now, the internet today has a lot of dominant companies in terms of simple market share, but dominant share is not illegal per se. Antitrust law restricts anti-competitive practices, agreements, and mergers. Is it dangerous that in practice size itself is going to attract more scrutiny when scrutiny itself can be the sanction? Now, the EU actually has an obligation to scrutinize companies above a certain market threshold, but I'm mindful, if I look at the EU and I look at the United States, I would argue, and I think few in this room would disagree, there's more innovation happening here than there is in the EU. And so we ought to proceed, I think, quite cautiously in attacking merely for size those companies that are innovators. It seems to me that, you know, the world that we have today is not Standard Oil, where the antitrust laws of the United States played a crucial role in making sure that the market worked. But with fast innovation, low barriers to entry, does antitrust law play the same role in the internet world, in the tech world that we see today? I don't know if I should say this, but I will anyhow. Jim Sensenbrenner and I, and Jim's a very conservative member of Congress, and I'm not, but he and I have discussed the concept of having basically a seminar on antitrust law for the members of the House Judiciary Committee. And it would not be, with no agenda, not to benefit any company or party, bring in professors so that the members of the Judiciary Committee would actually have a basic understanding of antitrust. antitrust law. And we're actually working with a former staffer of the committee to line up something that will be absolutely impeccable and useful. And one of the reasons why I think that's important is that as the scrutiny of the Department of Justice can chill a particular merger or line of innovation, the scrutiny of the legislative branch can have that same impact. It can signal to the department that the Congress is concerned. It can signal to the company that they're in trouble if they're moving down a particular road. And it can be used in an improper fashion. Without mentioning any individuals, I mean, there have been inquiries where I know that individual members of Congress are reading the talking points of the competitors of a company that is being looked at. And so it's really the antitrust scrutiny and oversight of the committee is used as an economic tool by one competitor versus another. It's a completely wildly inappropriate use of the legislative oversight function. And I think that it is fed by a lack of information. And it, again, reinforces the point that I've come to, which is not actually the filing of the lawsuit, but the expression of interest that actually will deter a high-tech a company from in moving in a particular line of inquiry or developing a technology. I think that that is something that needs to be reviewed in terms of how the internet works compared to old line industries. The traditional antitrust review has focused on short-term measures of competition, market shares, prices that consumers pay, but the pace of innovation and competitive change is so much faster in the technology industries, and especially software and on the internet, that those traditional measures may not be the appropriate ones to use. And I will posit this suggestion that enforcement agencies, and I would maybe include Congress, should place innovation at the center of their decision making and explicitly consider how competition, mergers, and potentially anti-competitive practices will affect longer-term innovation instead of just focusing on current market prices. When I take a look at the various elements of innovation in this valley, they're all the way from little teeny startups to gigantic behemoths. When the Microsoft case was brought, AOL was the big dog in the internet. And AOL does it exist today? I don't know. Netscape, when I went to visit Netscape, they told that people would come from all over the world and kind of worship the little fountain that they have there. And of course, I guess Netscape exists, but no one would use it. So certainly the speed of change, the dynamism of the internet makes this, at least the software side of the internet, a very more agile business space than anything else. I would potentially argue a different case for the hardware world. So I think the real issue is whether the action of the internet player increases the barrier to entry, promotes long-term innovation, precludes startups and other small innovators from being competitive. I think those are the issues that need to be addressed by the regulators, not the courts, because by the time we get to the courts, it's all over. There are unintended consequences for this action in the antitrust world, and I'm not at all convinced that the federal government is now considering those unintended consequences. I want to talk just very briefly about the role of copyright. Certainly, intellectual property, patents, and copyrights are granted monopoly power on the part of the federal government to an entity for a limited period of time. In the case of copyrights, the life of the author is 95 years, quite limited. Say it's the life of Mickey Mouse, is whatever this does copyright term. But the interplay of copyright and technology protection of copyright, I think, has has had the effect of tremendously destroying the ability of innovators to enter market fields. And although traditionally antitrust enforcers have never looked specifically at the copyright claim, I do think that is an element that is worthy of consideration of the antitrust enforcers, not to the original copyright owner, but as the network effect, the interplay between technology used to protect the grant, the copyright grant, and its display over networks really has an impact of impeding entry into business areas, raising barriers to entry. That, I think, was certainly not intended when the copyright laws were written, and it certainly is worthy of scrutiny. So with that, I am looking forward to having some serious questions and comments, because this is an emerging area that has tremendous significance. And before I turn to the panelists, I need to introduce them. First, we have Kathy Sandoval. I must say, Cindy Avitia on my staff said that you were her professor. She said to say hello. Kathy Sandoval is an assistant professor of law at Santa Clara University, where she teaches mass communication regulation, antitrust law, and contracts. She has two publications coming out this year, a telecommunications casebook and an article for a law review on the role of the FTC's deceptive conduct provisions in the net neutrality debate. We have Timothy Bresnahan, who is chairman of the economics department at Stanford University on an undergraduate online, and the Landau Professor of Technology and the Economy. His research focuses on industrial organization and the economies of technology, and he was formerly the chief economist of the antitrust division of the DOJ. And Michael Katz, at Stanford, Michael Katz holds the Sarah Sharon Strategy and Leadership, and is a professor from the economics department and the Haas School of Business. He previously served as deputy assistant attorney general for economic analysis in the antitrust division of the United States Department of Justice, and as the chief economist at the FCC. A distinguished panel, I look forward to hearing their comments.
Pursues its decisions much less based on the facts. That it is makes much greater use, and this is true under Democratic and Republican chairman alike, much greater use of threatening companies when it knows it couldn't prove in court or uphold its decisions it'd like to impose, but it has a tremendous amount of power and essentially can blackmail companies. So I think actually there's a lot of danger, and I worry quite a bit that the FCC going forward in the name of promoting innovation is in fact going to be promoting particular private interests and will be able to misuse the threats as it goes along and does that. I guess that's the biggest thing. I would just mention one other thing that has to be very brief, and I'm happy to discuss these more. Yeah, there's this question about the speed at which markets change, and sometimes people point to the Microsoft case and say, oh, you know, look how quickly they changed, because when the case was started back in the 90s, and actually it's a sequence of cases, Microsoft was by far the dominant provider of operating systems for personal computers, and Apple was kind of behind them. Now look how things have changed in the last whatever year. So frankly, I think some of the stuff about speed is overstated. Microsoft is still the dominant one. But the other thing is I think the notion that the regulators will move faster mistaken, and actually for a couple of reasons. First of all, the FCC is subject to judicial review. And second of all, the FCC moves very slowly. Take the case of mergers. I've done consulting and also was at the Department of Justice on merger cases. And it's always a luxury when you do telecom cases versus others. So if you're doing a non-telecom merger, you're subject to the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act and you have to actually move along and get things done. But fortunately, if it's a telecom merger, you don't, because if the parties can't close, you don't have to act. And if the FCC hasn't told them they can close, you don't have to act. And the FCC takes a long, long time for mergers. In fact, I think that's something to merit congressional oversight or additional oversight. Because again, it's a way to blackmail companies. And you see this, something the Justice Department would never do. The FCC will frequently ask for merger conditions that have nothing to do with the merger. The DOJ is much more disciplined and won't do that, and I think it's, and others have said this, including I was on a panel with Michael Powell, former FMC, commissioner, but the chair of the FCC, and he said the same thing that he thought was blackmail. I'll give another example, the Cable National Ownership Act. The commission had a proceeding, came up with a rule, court, D.C. Circuit struck it down, FCC came back, I think several years later, another rule, D.C. Circuit said, look, this is completely pretextual, you got to be, this is a serious thing. Acted down again. Came up with another rule, and now I think some like 7 or 8 years later, we're waiting to hear from the D.C. Circuit again what's going to happen. So I think the notion that the FCC and the regulators move quickly, unfortunately, it would be nice if it were true, but my experience
is I share Mike's problem on agreeing with almost everything that has been said. So my approach is going to be to try and sharpen two of the remarks you made, which I think was spot on. And there are two very different remarks. One is the possibility of chilling scrutiny, and the other is the possibility of moving innovation concerns to the center of competition policy. I would sharpen these by saying that they apply with particular force to very different policy areas. That the power of near antitrust scrutiny to chill private behavior is strongest in the merger area. It's strongest in the merger area because except when merger deals, which are basically cash for the banks, the merger parties tend to hear the clock ticking on Wall Street. And so the mere threat of an enforcement action gives enormous power to the enforcement agencies. And I mean, it's extremely important that power can be adequately constrained so as not to be, not to be used for any question other than does this merger harm American consumers either today through prices or more importantly down the road through innovation. And just really focusing on that. I think the problem of chilling scrutiny is much smaller in when So there, you know, I think that the problem of showing innovation by threatening to bring enforcement actions, you know, where there are things that make their country is much less of a problem. It is, however, I think extremely important to focus those enforcement actions on cases like the AT&T case of the 80s or the Microsoft case of the late 90s, where you have an incumbent dominant firm in which people may think they're innovative. what's going on, the basic logic of both of those cases is you have outside innovation, which brings me back to what I think should be the theme of Ms. Varney's threat to be more of an active alpha block about those matters, or actually bringing those matters forward, is that the agency should be extremely careful that those are pro-competitive and pro-innovative matters. And you're dealing with one of these cases where outside innovation is transforming whole industries. Those happen. They don't happen every week. We'll see whether the current business department finds one. I couldn't name one for you today, where I think there's an incumbent either in Silicon Valley or elsewhere that has become as backward looking as either of those two things, and it's the past of AT&T and Microsoft. But if they find one and they find that there are barriers to entry, they're keeping out important limited technology.
What I'd like to talk about a couple of themes that I think all of my colleagues and Congressman Lofgren's remarks raised. So first of all, I had a guest speaker in my antitrust class a couple of years ago, and I won't say what company they work from, but there were two of them. And they talked about that, sometimes when you're working with other companies, sometimes you're competitors, sometimes you're partners, and the word for that is cooperation. Competition and cooperation at the same time. So cooperation can also bring about innovation and can yield many fruits, but at the same time, we also have reason to have antitrust scrutiny about cooperation. So we've heard about another example of a proposal to do this, the joint venture essentially between Microsoft and Yahoo. And always the question that is at the heart of most antitrust matters becomes, what is the relevant market? In order to determine if it's anti-competitive, first of all, we have to determine, do they compete in the same market, and would this cooperation increase the market share to an extent that we should be concerned about it? And, of course, market definition issue comes up in the same way with regard to monopolization cases. When we're talking about single firm conduct, we're basically talking about abuse of monopoly power or attempts to monopolize over time. And merger cases. So on that theme, I've been taking this survey for several years, and this was really the big question in the Microsoft case, but here's the informal survey. So how many of you are willing to give up your PC or PC-type device, okay, a computer like Eli has? Eli, raise your hand, so you've got a computer in front of you, and rely solely on your cell phone or your smartphone? Raise your hand. Okay. So this was the point that Microsoft brought up, is that one of the things they said in market definition was smartphones need to be included within the market as a competitor to PCs. And that was years ago. And now here we are with iPhones and Blackberries, and you, the tech savvy, not a single one of you is willing to give that up and rely solely on your smartphone. Well, because I also work on FCC issues, and Michael and I had the pleasure of working together at the FCC when I was the director of the Office of Communications Business Opportunities at the FCC, and he was the chief economist, So of course, we're both working in the public interest for the FCC, and one of the reasons that the FCC works differently is the FCC also has a different mandate. The FCC is not there to enforce antitrust laws. That's the job of the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission. The FCC is there to enforce the Communications Act. The Communications Act is all about the public interest. But I'd like to suggest one thing, and this is sort of a crossover between antitrust and broadband, that one reason that none of you are willing to give up your PC and rely solely on a smartphone, aside from the size of the screen and keyboard will kill you, is the practices of your internet service providers. And so one of the things that I plan on filing with the FCC is the Congresswoman mentioned, I'm writing an article that's called Disclosure Deception and Deep Packet Inspection, the Role of the Federal Trade Commission after the Deceptive Conduct Provisions in the Net Neutrality Debate. And I argue that we need more disclosure from ISPs about what they're doing, but also that the FCC needs to step in to stop requiring more deceptive practices, and that the FCC also needs to investigate as well. And part of that should be requiring more disclosures about what their practices are. And as we all know, the sine qua non market definition is substitutability. Now, all of you said none of you was willing to substitute your smartphone or PC. Yet the FCC, even in their proposed changes to how they count broadband, is counting in their latest charts availability of broadband over cell phones. But the problem with broadband over cell phones is that not only may there be difference in terms of speed limits, but I'd like to require that all ISPs have to also disclose what are their bandwidth limits and their bandwidth limits per tier. And one of the things that's very common, especially with the cell phone internet access, is not only download an application limits, but that you can only download what a cell phone ISP approves, which is completely different from the model on regular PCs. Limits the use of protocols. So many ISPs actually prohibit the use of programs such as peer-to-peer protocol. And peer-to-peer is not simply being used by college students who would illegally trade programs, but also by subscribing organizations as National Geographic, the NBA, the NFL, and other organizations in order to make their video available. But yet, some terrestrial ISPs and many cell phones limit the use of certain protocols, including peer-to-peer. Most cell phones also prohibit the use of a cell phone for tethering to your computer. You're not supposed to use it to link it to your computer for internet access. And in certain cases, they may allow you to do so if you pay them a lot more money, but even then, there are certain bandwidth limits. And then there's also limits on the use of applications, such as you can only use these applications with Wi-Fi. Examples of that include Slingbox. iPhone is limiting to Slingbox to Wi-Fi, and iPhone is also limiting Skype to Wi-Fi. And so the FCC is now looking into also, for example, why has iPhone turned down Google's application to have Google Phone be one of the applications available on Wi-Fi? And the reason that the FCC is looking into that is because the Supreme Court last year, or earlier this year, in the Lingfline case, looking at the attempt of an independent internet service provider to gain access to AT&T's network, the Supreme Court basically said that AT&T and other internet service providers have no duty to deal under antitrust law with these potential competitors. And any duty to deal only comes from FCC regulation. And so, while I agree that that is true as a matter of antitrust law, and then looking in terms of what is distinguishing between what is actually predatory pricing and what is not, it highlights also one of the important issues, which is the role of regulation and regulatory agencies such as the FCC, because the FCC did impose on AT&T a duty to deal with independent internet service providers as a condition of its merger with SEC, because they were afraid that what is happening would happen, which is that they would not deal or would only deal at extremely high prices. And the SEC did impose a duty to deal, but it said nothing about pricing or terms and conditions. So in that regard, they have been a little not. They did not require basically non-discrimination or common carrier type of obligations in terms of treatment. So I think we're going to be seeing more scrutiny of cooperation. Also, the Deputy Attorney General Barney signaled their willingness to look at monopolization cases, and one of the ones that they're looking at, and I'll just end this quick example, is the Google Book Summit about the scanning of the books. So a noble project to create a global digital library, but a class action lawsuit has accused this project of engaging in massive copyright violations. And so they have entered into a proposed settlement. Well, there are a couple of issues with the proposed settlement, and the DOJ is looking into that. So the Congressman Boucher talked about the difference between opt-in and opt-out. So this proposed settlement would make all active or identifiable copyright users have to opt out of the settlement. And it would also give Google the rights to all what's called orphan books, where there's still a copyright on the book, but the copyright holder or the person who has the rights to the copyright holder can't be found, is when the person has died and they can't find the heirs. And it would basically, by default, give Google the right to all of those books. So one hand, on the one hand, innovation, it would bring those open books, make them available digitally across the globe. But the question is, does that settlement erect tremendous barriers to entry so that no one else can basically come in because of the way that the settlement has created these issues? So I think those are a variety of themes that we need to look at and to think about what is the appropriate role for the antitrust authorities and what is the appropriate role for regulatory authorities.
Thank you. I'll just make a couple of comments since everyone agreed with me as far to discuss. But I will say just this, that we're in an interesting era now where it's correct, the FCC does not have antitrust. Antitrust portfolio, but because of their duty to look after consumers, they end up dealing with matters that really relate tangentially, at least, to these issues. And I think that if we keep in mind where we're trying to go, we're trying to go open platforms, we're trying to go pro-innovation, we're trying to go easy entry to competitors. And so if you have your cooperation, I've not heard that. So if it leads to a broader access to open access, to open platforms, it leads to further innovation, then that's on the good side. If there could be a less useful cooperation. Finally, I can't resist talking about the Google Book deal, even though I said I wouldn't talk about a particular issue, because we tried for several years after the Supreme Court case on the Sonny Bono Copyright Extension Act was wrongly decided. It was pointed out in that the majority of works in the world are orphaned, and they were unavailable to the public. And we tried on a bipartisan basis to put together a legislative scheme to make those orphan works available with the Library of Congress and the Copyright Office of Law. To make it a long story short, we failed. We failed because no one could agree, and so we moved on. And what Google actually has done is they've accomplished that. And they have scanned, I actually, during the course of trying to put together the orphan works, Albert tried to put the Publishers Association together with the libraries. What they did was they would, you ask for forgiveness, not permission, when you're moving forward. And they went ahead to scan, starting with orphaned works, but honestly, much of the material we think is orphan, really is an orphan, it's in the public domain because it wasn't re-registered when that was required, and ultimately sued and they settled. They have a non-profit that is set up to facilitate dealing with authors, which is the role that we were trying to get the Copyright Office to play, which they couldn't do and didn't want to do and didn't know how to do. And anybody who wants to go scan a bunch of books and wait to be sued by the publishers and do their own class action settlement, there's no problem. This is not an exclusive deal. And I don't believe, actually, it's probably lowered the barrier to entry because of the technology developments that is, again, not exclusive, that anyone can go ahead and do what they want. Whether anyone will, I don't know, because it has been so helpful moving forward the knowledge of the world. I'll just say this, in talking to Google, I mentioned to them how grateful I was that they had essentially accomplished what the Congress had been able to do, and they said they'd be happy to support an Orphan Works bill to basically replicate or put their deal out of business. They just wanted to advance the knowledge, and I appreciate that they did.
Innovation. I'm an innovator, tech seller, Carnegie Mellon. I was struck the other day when I was listening on the radio with somebody complaining, somebody at Mann Hall, complaining that they can't compete with the internet. Now we've had a moratorium on taxes for commercial uses of the internet. And now we're looking at the, we used to get our media and content delivery from, talking to people and books and TV, radio, but now it's really complex. I mean, these phones, when I get an application on my phone, it seems as though there's really one platform with a very strict idea of what can or cannot be on that iPhone that is controlling that. And yet, that's what opened up the innovation to plugins for applications on a smartphone. And I guess this question from a policy point of view, when is it time to tax again? When is it time to allow an Apple to have a closed system so that innovation will bloom? And how do we change that without finding ourselves in the situation you were describing, where my gosh, so I've been working on stuff, but this cloud and I can't move over to anything else. I can't move over to another app because it's all locked into the standards. Even aesthetics of one platform.
If I can just start, there really isn't a prohibition on taxes. There's a prohibition on discriminatory taxes. And so entities, if they can establish jurisdiction to tax the transaction, they're free to do so. And some, in fact, do. As to somebody asked, would you give up? I guess it was you. Your smartphone for a PC. If Apple would address their battery problem and untether their from the AT&T network so I could have some competition and get decent service, I would. That's just me. But I do think you need to have, look ahead and not at what is today but what could be. And that really is, okay, I don't like the fact that my iPhone, which I love that iPhone, obviously, is tethered in a way that I find confining. But I also know that Gainon is Android and a bunch of other competitors who, if they can't get access to the iTunes, are going to create a competitor. And the big constraint, I think, is copyright law. Which is why I mentioned my opening statement, but the ability in very quick order to create a competitive, attractive competitor is really quite present. We really need to look at where where not only the FCC, but the antitrust enforcement agencies even look, where there's little choke points where you create a barrier to entry so that those competitors cannot have an opportunity to provide that.
It's even the question brings up, I think, one of the most important, maybe the most important point in thinking about innovation, antitrust, and competition more broadly. And you've got to think about not just what happens after you've got a platform there or after investments have been made. Wouldn't it be nice if everybody could share them and have access to facilities for free? But you have to think about the longer term and what the incentives are for creating the new products in the first place, which was invested in the facilities. And for that reason, I mean, it's simply false to claim, as a general matter, to claim that open platforms are the best way to promote innovation. other reason, you may not get the open, you may not get the platform in the first place if it has to be open. And actually, even when you have the platform, open platforms are not always the best thing. I'll give you now a very dated and old example. When video games first came out, they were open platforms. Anyone could put a game on Atari. It's one of the things that killed Atari off, because it turns out people put all sorts of pornographic games on and incredibly low-quality games and everything else. And one of the big innovations by Nintendo was to say, hey, wait a minute, what we need to do is actually have a managed platform, because we're going to let lots of other people develop games and applications for our platform, but we're going to oversee the quality. We're going to create an environment that gives them incentives to also serve the interests of the overall platform, because that's how we'll make money. So I actually think if I had to pick a particular form, sort of partially managed, or though I think this is the phrase light-handed regulation for anything, but sort of lightly regulated platform, I think one dog is really the one that's most conducive to innovation. And of course, the real answer is it depends very much on the circumstances. And so it's important that competition policy be open to that, to realize that some forms of network management are good, that closed platforms be good in some circumstances, is vertical integration would be good. And lastly, it comes back, you know, pick up on something maybe not she would want to say, but maybe sitting in front of the congresswoman said, but you know, suppose it turns out when Apple's asked, well, why don't, you know, why on the iPhone, why wouldn't you let them run Google's applications? They said, we don't want to help Google with competing against them. Under antitrust law, there would be nothing wrong with that given the state of the cell phone market. This notion that the iPhone somehow is a dominant handset in the antitrust sense, or an essential facility, I think is wildly overstated. I think it's just, there's no way it would hold up before, which is why we'll see these things in the FCC, as long as the Justice Department investigating the iPhone. I will predict, I bet anyone who wants to, there's no chance that they could win a case on that. And I mean, the important point is it's stimulating competition. There are multiple cell phone networks, they have a lot of manufacturers, and so I think that's what we've got to do.
If I may, I think you're right on that. It's annoying to people, but it's probably not an antitrust violation. But the point, the thing that I want to get back to, and that I know we've run out of time, is that the scrutiny itself, even if you could never win a case, intense scrutiny can affect behavior. And there's no, you know, ultimately a court will be a constraint on that, but because the commercial world and the internet space moves so quickly, that constraint on the government is almost meaningless. And so this is an area really where we've not yet figured out how to get this one right, and it involves not just the federal government but also the Congress, and I think we've got a ways to go.
Just a couple of quick comments on that. So I think that we are seeing, certainly in the cell phone and smartphone market, an increasing use of closed platforms. Part of Apple's defense, so I took my antitrust class last year to one of the oral arguments in one of the many cases against the iPhone, alleging tying as well as abuse of monopoly power. And their argument was basically, you don't like our business model, and this is all about attacking our business model. So there is a question about, you know, is this just about their business model? And in fact, the Supreme Court's antitrust jurisprudence, I would argue, has actually encouraged the creation of closed platforms, because the Aspen Steam case and some of the cases that have followed basically suggested you've never established a pattern of cooperation with your competitors, then you don't have to cooperate. It's once you establish a pattern and you break that pattern that then that creates problems. So Comcast actions in blocking furniture might be one example of that. But that being said, I think that it's, you know, we started with an internet that was open, and I think most of us would be very unhappy if the only option for the internet was a bunch of closed systems that were all proprietary, and we were going back to the Prodigy type of model. You know, my poster does certain functions very well, but we want something that is a multifunctional application. And the other thing that is my personal pet peeve, and some of us, I wrote a 90-page article about it, in Disclosure, Deception, and Impact and Inspection, is also, and this is particularly true in the mobile world, but also for some other ISPs, I need to tell you, you get unlimited internet access. Well, what does unlimited internet access mean when they have significant application restrictions, as well as restrictions on submit to you, even without taking a survey, that most of you are unwilling also to trade your television, cable, or satellite for your smartphone. And again, it's because I understand that there are bandwidth limit issues, but that there are also these policies that are adopted by the ISPs that basically prevent that type of substitution.
The question picks up what I think that I was right at the very beginning, which is there are pro-competitive policy changes, like cell phone number portability. The lack of cell phone number portability didn't violate the antitrust laws either. Maybe we portable, maybe the cloud data more portable to the extent it's technically feasible, is pro-competitive and pro-consumer. That's an example of something which is appropriate to do with regulation and legislation, not particularly appropriate to do by enforcement.
Yeah, for Tim Bresnahan, my name is Joel West, I'm from San Jose State, and you alluded to it in your discussion of antitrust that the American standard for antitrust is pro-consumer, whereas Europe has recently been using extraterritorial enforcement of antitrust to impose a different standard of does it harm competitors? And so I was wanting to ask you and any other panelists who have evidence, in the past 10 years, can you think of a case where applying this higher standard that doesn't harm competitors would have protected consumers in the long run? In other words, are we in fact protecting consumers under our current standard, or if in fact do we need to think about protecting competitors because if the competitors go away, then the consumers won't have competition and choice?
No.
Thank you.
For example, in the European Union, in its some of us important Microsoft case, was extremely careful to plead a case that would have worked under either U.S. or the U.S. And I think the European courts missed a wonderful opportunity to move European antitrust law onto
you know, you raise an important issue, which is that the standards are different in Europe. The standards for what is dominant and what is monopoly power is much lower in Europe. And also in Europe, there are still many more per se prohibitions. So, for example, resale price maintenance is still per se illegal as price fixing in Europe, whereas the Supreme Court decided a couple of years ago that it should be evaluated under a rule of reason. So, under resale price maintenance, you know, if the maker of this case wants to decide this case shall not be sold for less than $20, they can dictate that to the retailer, and that is no longer a per se violation of antitrust laws in the United States, but it is a per se violation of antitrust laws in Europe. So there are definitely some differences, and this results from things like this last month. The European Commission fined Intel 1.5 billion euros for paying computer makers to delay or cancel products that contain the rival chips. So compare that in the United States with the continuing debate about pharmaceutical settlements. Now, some of those, again, come out of lawsuits and settlements, and there's some argument that a certain language may be being allowed out of settlements that might not be allowed otherwise. But you have in the pharmaceutical settlements an holder of a patent paying a generic to stay out of the market for some period of time as part of the settlement of the patent lawsuit. So there are arguments, again, about whether or not that is competitive, but I think in the short run, the purpose is to keep prices higher. And that would certainly be condemned in Europe and is permitted in the United States.
So far, absolutely.
So far.
That's, I think, it's likely a subject of action.
I have a dream that someday we're going to stop talking about that issue. And I'm just, not a wonderful thing to have open platforms and innovation and free bandwidth and business partners for everybody. So but because there are too many ideas that are trying to tackle themselves into that one label, to ever make any sort of meaningful progress towards a regulatory, enforceable regulatory regime that won't have incredibly bad science. And K1 coined the term in 2003, proposed some regulation in the paper in which he coined it, and I'm still waiting for a bill that doesn't make me laugh, with my background in network engineering, about the naivete of the way that bandwidth management issues are dealt with in these measures. So I just want to make a plea that if you're concerned about any competitive practices, concerned about deceptive trade practices, that's all fine and good, but don't imagine that bandwidth is free, that bandwidth is unlimited, that we have ever had a network in which anybody can do anything he wants at any time without affecting anybody else, and that we never will.
Network neutrality. I mean, I think that we can agree on a couple of principles, right? ISP should not lie to people, so, you know, we should tell people this is what we're going to be delivering and then give you what you deliver. I think we also need to look, for example, at the role of contract modification, and this is the way that they're able to do certain things. Just, you know, I analogize it as like that double game where, you know, you can use the Greyhound is chasing the money. So the Greyhound can never chase the money because the contract keeps changing, and you have absolutely no idea that your contract is changing. As soon as unilateral contract modification, your ISP continually is prohibiting new things that you didn't know that they prohibited. So this is one of the things that, for example, iPhone did with Slingboxes. Right before iPhone said you can only use Slingbox on Wi-Fi, they modified their contract so that it was consistent with the new modification, although it would have been sustained consistent with the contract. So, and then I think also we talked a little bit about interoperability. So the FCC was very successful in bringing the standards through a proceeding called Part 68 that basically allows one telephone to be able to call another telephone because we have certain standards of interoperability. So I think that might also be another way to look at this is can we come up with some common standards so that everybody knows what the playing field is. I mean, I agree bandwidth is not unlimited, but also ISP should not be able to constantly move the ball on people or also do nefarious things that are designed deliberately to disadvantage competitive, potentially competitive uses such as video when they also operate video platforms.
I'll just add, I think that the prevailing view in the Congress at this point is to look and see what the regulators do on this issue instead of the legislators. I think that's correct, since we now have some hope that there will be some regulatory action. And the issue really isn't whether ISPs need to manage their bandwidth. They do. The question, or whether it's free, it isn't. The question is how that occurs and whether in the legitimate need to manage bandwidth, it's going to be bootstrapped to dictate to customers which of various content they can access. And I think that's legitimate, and I think the FCC has already made some steps forward, and it will be more successful than the legislation would.
That's the claim on this, like, disclosure in the contract situation. Like, legally, you shouldn't deceive customers. They don't agree about the part about not making changes because of the way you do it. Apple could just put in its contract from now on. From time to time, we will change what applications we're allowed, and then they will disclose it. But the strong thing I want to say is I think the disclosure stuff, I would very much rather see that being dealt with by the State Attorney General and by the Federal Trade Commission under the General Consumer Protection and Fraud Law. I think it's a mistake to keep thinking we've got to have industry-specific rules for all these different. For sure, we've got some of the technologies are different, but I think the basic contract issues we're talking about actually are not unique to this industry. And I think there's a real danger when you start having industry specific rules, because then it starts serving particular competitors as opposed to sort of broader trade offs. And that's one of the reasons why I think, what I said earlier, that the DOJ is, I think, much more disciplined than the FCC. It's not that there are better people at the DOJ than the FCC, that they're more honest or try harder or whatever. I think it's the FCC
parties, and the DOJ, by its mandate, is forced to take a broader and more balanced view.
I have stolen more than 5 minutes from the conference, so I apologize. Thank you for joining us. What we'll do is then steal a few minutes from lunch, if you'll allow. I want to thank the congressman for a fascinating panel and the panelists. It was fascinating. We'll take a short coffee break and come back with Secretary Shumpert.